Hello, dear friends. This is Brett, and I'm trying to be very quiet right now because I'm in a big, echoey room, and that's especially challenging because I'm so excited. There are so many muffins in the oven related to the show, and I'll tell you about a few of these. This coming Monday, I'm going to be releasing a show with a former public school teacher. Wait till you hear about why he's not a public school teacher anymore, or one of the reasons, one of the reasons. His name is Matt Shumsky, and he wrote an article for Grace Llewellyn's blog that we're going to be talking about on the show. Starting next week, you will hear the first of a two-part series that I did with my friends from Online Great Books, Scott Hambrick and Dr. Carl Schutt, on Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals. It's a long overdue deep dive into that book. It's more relevant than ever in many ways. And we had a great 3-hour conversation about it last week that I'm going to split up and release one next week and one the week after that. Also, Daryl Becker and I will continue our series. We've recorded part 3, but I'm looking into a few things a little more closely, and we will resume that around the beginning of June. Dutch and I are preparing to record the next episode of the Picture of the Month Club. We are going to be doing the film No Country for Old Men. It is about time that we welcome the Coen brothers to the old clubhouse. Picture of the Month Club. And earlier this week, I put out the latest, the 9th installment of In Pursuit of Utopia, a series I've been doing with my friend Danny McCarthy, whose book, go to his website, ageofutopia.info, learn more about the book he recently finished on the subject that we've been covering for most of the last year. For the last 3 episodes, we've been lucky enough to have Kevin Cole from unityofthepolis.com joining us. Kevin is a researcher and an author and a rapper. Like, a lot of people don't know that. Maybe we'll talk about that more. So anyway, here's the thing. Kevin is actually going to join us on future episodes of In Pursuit of Utopia. Our next show is supposed to be about the progressive era, and that is also probably going to be multiple parts, the progressive era. I kind of want to do, I don't think it's necessarily a detour, but I want to do a whole episode on Fabian socialism. It's a fascinating subject. I haven't even pitched that idea yet to the guys. And there's a lot of other things going on too. We had a bit of a problem with the website, with actually all our websites. So that's schoolsucksproject.com and the sspuniversity.com site. We were hacked. It is one of the most sophisticated attacks that we've ever endured. As I record this, I am locked out of my own website, and the University site won't even load a page. Now, you can go to schoolsucksproject.com. I just can't post anything to it. So, enjoy stuff that I did in the past if you go there. So today's clip, it's about 20 minutes, and a lot can happen in 20 minutes in an episode of In Pursuit of Utopia. This comes from the one I just posted this week. It's episode 9. It's called New Harmony and Beyond. And it has these interesting bookends of the two conversations that I had with the Online Great Books guys, Online Great Bookends. The first show that I did with them was Marshall McLuhan's The Medium is the Massage, or The Medium is the Message. And this upcoming one, Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals. And there's a lot of discussion in between about ends and means, which is a huge feature of Rules for Radicals. And it comes up in our conversation about various attempts at socialist utopias. So in this 20 minutes, we go a lot of places. It's about a fifth of the entire show, where we go even more places. And it's like a self-contained little episode inside a bigger episode. Thanks for all the positive feedback we've gotten about In Pursuit of Utopia. Thanks for all the positive feedback, like the overwhelmingly positive feedback about the shows that I'm currently doing with Daryl Becker. I am relieved. But critics, please step forward. We are certainly interested in hearing from you as well. So that's everything. I will be back on Monday with a fine conversation with Matt Shumsky, who is a former public school teacher and currently an education graduate student in Oregon. I'm really looking forward to getting that show into your pointy little ears. So that's it. Have a great weekend. Have a great holiday. You know what? That Matt show that I just mentioned, it's going to be Tuesday. Let's not have too much going on Monday. So have a great weekend. Happy Memorial Day, I think it is. If you want to access all episodes of In Pursuit of Utopia, all episodes of Picture of the Month Club, all episodes of The Discomfort Zone, and every other bonus show we've done back to 2016, please go to patreon.com/schoolsucks. Your support really helps us out, especially right now. and it gets you access to, you know, frankly, some of the best content we've ever created. I like to think of myself as going above and beyond for the people who help keep this show going and growing. And we're doing both. And there's lots of exciting opportunities right now that I'm looking to seize upon, but more about that soon. All right, everybody, have a great holiday. Have a great weekend. I will talk to you next week.
Marshall McLuhan, for his thesis when he was going to school, I forgot the university that he was at, wrote a book on the classical trivium in the place of Thomas Nash. And so he was very interested in the ideas of the trivium. And he was using the trivium as an example to kind of educate somebody historically. And he then goes on to become this major futurist technocracy advocate of cybernetic reality. Predicted meme culture before meme culture existed.
Predicted a lot. Yeah, a lot of interesting things.
Yeah. And I gather his son is taking over his archives and is putting some media out now so people can check that out. But he wrote a book called The Medium is the Message, which in a lot of ways took the ideas of Norbert Wiener and the early cyberneticist and made them more palatable to the general public culturally. And he did so in a way that he basically recognized the ruse. But instead of pointing out the ruse as something that would be damaging to you, he kind of saw it as the next step in technological evolution. He denoted quite thoroughly and accurately the differences between individualized book learning and television and radio mediums. So like when you read books, you are creating the world from within introspectively. You are reading the words on the pages. You are using the references in your mind of what a tree is or what a building is or what the guy who's in love is or whatever it is, rather than this visual forced representation of what that reality is, one that is just taken in passively. Whereas as somebody that's reading books, you're participating in the active literacies rather than the passive literacies. And I think most of these technological mediums of today are set up as, you know, a kind of passive literacy or a passive way of taking in information. Now they can certainly be used for other ways as we are doing today as a general FU to that original intentionality people took from Norbert Wiener's work and sought to systematize through the CIA and the Macy conferences, really to try to create society as a feedback mechanism, a cybernetic feedback loop that is self-sustaining. And when you look at the work of William Torrey Harris and you look at these earlier utopian projects, they're doing the same thing. These guys were doing systems theory before systems theory had been codified by the Prussian sciences and Humboldtian science. And these ideas are the most important ideas of our time if you are interested in real change and real possibilities of affecting any type of movement from the type of society we have today. And I would think somebody like Buckminster Fuller, you know, he called himself Trim Tap because he didn't really see himself as being able to affect the large kind of change that he idealistically felt would be necessary for humans to live in a much more sound manner. He saw himself as like the little trim tab on the back of the boat that would tilt it from one side to the other to get it to go in another direction. And Buckminster Fuller is not absent from this conversation. Buckminster Fuller's great aunt was Margaret Fuller, who was the assistant to Bronson Alcott at the Temple School in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. You know, so yeah, the medium is a message.
McLuhan coined the phrase all at onceness.
Yeah, so, yeah.
In Global Village, right?
Yes. Yeah. That was the other one. Yeah.
And what are we having right now? We're having a global all at onceness moment that's never happened before in our lifetime. You know, we can talk about past civilizations that may have gotten to this level of ubiquity, but like no religion has ever been able to reach the ubiquity as a pandemic virus.
Right.
You know, and so all around the world, everybody's, preaching the same pulpit, preaching at the same pulpit, saying the same words, social distance in whatever language possible, you can understand that, stay in your homes, you know. It's interesting. It's a scary, you know, McLuhan famously brought on the Beatles on one evening to his live radio broadcast. It was supposed to reach, you know, larger and larger polities around the world. They did like Give Peace a Chance or one of these things, you know. But it wasn't about the message of the Beatles. It was the message was the fact that they could do this thing where they could have like the biggest band in the world on this, you know, this big international audio. Now, I'll mention just as a small aside to that, that was interesting, but it really had nothing on the Pilgrim Society being able to use the Atlantic Wire before it was even available to the public or for government usage for the Pilgrims of New York, Nicholas Marie Butler and all these people to convene with the British wing of what would become the Royal Institute of International Affairs. So you had the Council on Foreign Relations on one side as in the Pilgrim Society. It's an amalgamation of both of these groups. Like when they'd come to the United States, they'd all meet. When they'd go to London, they'd all meet. But they were able to do the Atlantic Wire just because the guy that was running the Atlantic Wire happened to be a friend of the and a member of the Pilgrim Society. So to be able to harness technology before it is available to even the masses gives you a huge leg up on what you can do control-wise. And of course, that's seen with the creation of the red and blue NBC networks, monopolization of mainstream media news today. And if you can control that conversation, if you can be the one up there that gets to furrow your brow and look angry, you're going to get a lot of people through mimetic thinking alone to start thinking your way or to start giving credence to your authority. You know, for a while, I thought we were getting democratized on that level. I thought that YouTube was becoming somewhere where people could get on there and say contrary things. But now we're having a crisis of democracy, which is what Samuel Huntington said, who was a Trilateral Commission member. We're having a crisis of democracy where too many people are becoming politically involved and democracy isn't going to work anymore because of the outmoded nature of representation. And so now they're banning people. I mean, there's a lot of views of these people. Trust me, a lot of these people that are getting taken off YouTube, I don't necessarily agree with them, but I would never want them to be taken off of YouTube. You know, like Thomas Jefferson said, I don't care what idea exists as long as reason exists to combat it, you know, paraphrasing. And so we've become a nation of babies that like can't tolerate views, or the technology is so ubiquitous and it has been so democratized that even the most ridiculous among us can get a massive, massive following. Perhaps real damage comes of that. But I still don't agree with the top-down control or manipulation or crackdown on free thought and free thinking.
Geez, you know, I spent 3 hours yesterday talking to the guys from Online Great Books about Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals. Speaking of somebody else from the 60s, late 60s, early 70s, who predicted a lot of interesting thing where basically in the, like, as far as the world of meaning people into belief, where reason would not be an issue, he had a formula nailed as early as 1971. Well, probably before 1971. He published it in 1971. So, absolutely. Danny, get us back on track here.
Well, I wanted to comment on what Kevin said.
Oh, please. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The initial thing, anyway, the larger idea of, you know, for lack of a better word, the problem that we're trying to confront in these episodes has been this secular religious idea that through the ruling class's use of whatever systems of reason they're employing, they have decided upon what is objectively true and what is objectively good. And the kind of, I guess, slogan, not technically, but the slogan that I employ in my book has been, utopia is the belief or the employment of the belief that the ends justify the means. So if you have a objective, ultimately good for the most amount of people system sketched out in your head, what aren't you willing to do to get to it? And so, of course, one of the many examples I point to in the book is, you know, the Catholic Church in the Middle Ages. So they've got this holy city of God idea worked out. They've, in their minds anyway, they've developed a social system that comports perfectly with the nature of the universe, with the supreme law of God itself. So obviously, you know, if you believe that, and you could empathize with them, if you really believe that, well, then hell yeah. We got to get everybody out there underneath the system or all they're going to go to hell. So you can see it, but it still doesn't mean it's not crazy, but you can empathize with it. And of course, perhaps the easiest example of the same mentality, in my opinion, is the classic Soviet Union, got to break some eggs to make an omelet. Well, they wouldn't say that if they didn't believe that there was an omelet coming. At least somebody had to believe that breakfast was just around the corner. And I think that this is the tragedy and the hope, if I may, of New Harmony is that, okay, the socialist formula that Robert Owen laid out was the ends that later socialists would try to realize. So Marx and Engels, for instance, they didn't have so much of a problem with the results that Owen had wanted. Their only problem was in the administration. See, because Owen's thing was, well, let's just start it now. Let's just build the perfect society. Boom, there we are. And people will just flock to it naturally. And what Marx and Engels repudiated him for was like, well, that's not going to work. People aren't that smart yet. People aren't morally and rationally ready to accept the kind of socialism that Owen had organized. So their system was, we need to employ the levers of power. We need to take the state, reform people's natures from the top down using these institutions, and then magically one day people will just be so good that the state will wither away, and then we'll have the ideal. But in the course of realizing that ideal, you have to grind a lot of people to dust. So that's part of the legacy that I think is incredibly important, because on the one hand, we could see some of the worst evils coming out of that intellectual tradition that Owen kind of accidentally got rolling. But on the other hand, again, to reiterate what I said before, it's also a kind of demonstration of what freedom could have been, where if you've got an idea for a society, by all means, give it a shot. He didn't force anyone to go. I don't think anyone was forced to stay. So as far, like, it's kind of ironic, but the first socialist experiment was, technically speaking, very highly libertarian in that it was voluntarily undertaken. So it's again, this strange kind of push and pull where on the one hand, it was a free operation, but on the other hand, it inspired this absolutist mentality that, well, we have figured out the ideal society, and now we need to get it by any means necessary.
Okay.
And yeah, go ahead.
Interesting right there. Means and ends. Owen inspires people with ends, and then the project for the next 150 years or so is adjusting the means. When you have actors who are in more desperate situations, again, geez, why not just go back to Alinsky? I didn't think this would come up today, but here we are. You know, Alinsky wrote in that book, like, these rules, what he called them rules. I mean, we could debate whether they're hard and fast rules of ends and means. And he says the ethics of means vary inversely with a person's interest in the issue, right? So if you're living under Batista and you hear about this revolution, yeah, maybe some pretty gruesome shit is going to be necessary to bring that about. But it's always like, I don't want to say the ends are static, but for the most part, they are compared to what the means are that play out over the next 150 years.
Yes. And there are a few things there to address. I mean, on the one hand, it even goes back further, because when we look at Thomas More's Utopia in 1516, not that he was like necessarily advocating for political change. He was, but not to the extent that More and later, or that Owen and later socialists would. But he really presented this ideal as, here it is, but he doesn't really explain how the people in Utopia got to this perfect society. Then after him, Francis Bacon, he had a more workable, I suppose, model where he presented a perfect society, but said, look, it's going to have to be run by elite technocrats that nobody knows about. Kevin mentioned like the secularization of Christianity, turning it into a kind of like a decoration that people could just kind of believe in, but really the rulers believe something else. That started with Francis Bacon. It continued through Henri Saint-Simon. He came up with the new Christianity, where he said, we need to replace God the Father with gravity, Jesus with Isaac Newton, and the Holy Spirit with, I think, maybe Bacon or somebody like that. But nobody would really know that that was the case. Everyone would think they were still Christians. But I think that that speaks to what you just said about the ends remaining relatively static. And over the 150 years since Owen, it being an adjustment of the means. And that is the definition of cybernetics. That is what it is. You have a goal. It's all about reorienting your means to getting there. So when I describe cybernetics in my book, the analogy that I employ is simply shooting a basketball through a hoop. You know, you shoot the ball and it goes a little too far to the right, bounces off the rim. You don't change your goal of getting the ball in the hoop. You change your aim. You shift a little to the left, try again. And you do that over and over until it works. Except when it comes to societies where there are millions of people with their own hopes and dreams and aspirations, et cetera, you're not dealing with something as simple as a basketball hoop. And I think it's unfortunate that in the past 150, 200 years, we've seen that kind of cybernetic approach to society, which is it assumes, and I know every single episode, I think I always have to take it back to Plato, but it really goes back to that ship of state allegory from the Republic, which is where cybernetics comes from, by the way. He describes the ship as a great state that ought to be steered by a philosopher, and that was Kybernetes, came from the steersman of the ship. And what I say in my book is, that's nice, except a society is not a boat. That assumes that it has one destination, but a real society has as many destinations as it has residents. So this cybernetic approach of certain smart people have figured out ends that they have concluded are objectively good and desirable. So because they have been concluded to be objectively desirable, they're going to enforce them on us. And the only real concern on their part is not whether or not their ends are actually good. It's how do we get people most effectively there? And that's the cybernetic process. It's reorienting your actions to meet a goal. And to what you said about Alinsky and how, you know, if we were living under some sort of fascist regime, then okay, maybe we would be revolutionaries, at least more so than we are now. But I think that that's different because, at least to my thinking, and the way I've been approaching it in my book and in my larger work in general, has been the ends justify the means, to me, represents you employing means that are contradictory to your ends. So, for example, bringing freedom to the Middle East by invading and occupying. Like that's the contradiction there. I don't necessarily see a contradiction in taking up arms and fighting against an oppressive force in the name of freedom, because what you're doing is you're attempting to use means of violence to extirpate a threat, not to impose one temporarily like they did in the French Revolution, right? We need a committee of public safety to free everybody and it kills everyone. So I think the important differentiation is when you're looking at the ends justify the means, do your means contradict your stated ends? And again, I would reference Marxian socialism, so-called scientific anti-utopian socialism. It's far more utopian than the original socialism because it imagines that you can employ the coercive, centralized, all-powerful arm of the state and then change human nature, and then suddenly the state will go away and we'll all live in heaven.
Right. Well, Alinsky, just so you know, if you've never read Rules for Radicals, he has all kinds of escape hatches out of your proposal there. Okay. That there's an alignment between ends and means, right? That there's no contradiction. He has a lot of like qualifiers. The proverbial armchair that people sit in, right? When you get to sit in the armchair and think about these things, you can engage in the moral evaluations of your means. But when you've got a gun in your hand and the revolution is here, that's not important anymore. I think that's the argument that he would make. And ultimately, it's whether you succeed or you fail as far as how your means get evaluated ethically in the end.
Well, that's certainly true just from a realistic point of view. I mean, they say history is written by the winners. So
yeah.
That is the most important thing, I guess, you know, as far as history is concerned. But my modest suggestion to those in power or those with a grand social design is more like, you know, instead of constantly focusing on how to change and reorient your means, maybe take a look at your ends. Like maybe they're not that great. Maybe there's a reason most people aren't naturally inclined to those ends. I'm not saying that that's the case, but I just find it disturbing when people are so committed to an outcome that they're willing to entertain almost any means to attain it. That's like the scariest thing in the world to me, because you could justify anything in the name of the greatest good. So I like George Carlin said, you know, people talking about their needs and stuff, you know, oh, my needs aren't being met. He said, well, drop some of your needs. And I think that's the mentality I have toward these utopian thinkers. Like, oh, well, you know, our grandiose society isn't being met. Our ideals aren't all being checked off. It's like, well, drop some of them then. Maybe leave people alone. Maybe don't be so worried about micromanaging.
And how much of that is corrupted anyway by like Leninism, where it's like, hey, power, and then we'll figure it out.
Yeah.
You know, that references Alinsky a little bit too, where it's like, come to power, then we'll see what's what. Right. And that seems to be more of a game plan in the 20th century. I mean, who's that British filmmaker? Adam Curtis talked about that, right? Mm. Which, I mean, that movie's got its problems. I think that one is The Power of Nightmares, where he's like, people have lost faith in ideologies, right? Well, leaders have too. From the Russian Revolution on, we saw much more being about power acquisition and a lot less of like ideological pursuit.
For sure. For sure. There's a lot of, at least rhetorically, I notice among just like so-called regular old people, like people aren't ideologues. They're pragmatists. They're just like, you know, look, what's going to end this virus fast? They don't care about freedom. I mean, maybe on the 4th of July they do. But if somebody like me is like, hey, you know, maybe all this lockdown's not a good idea. I don't know the answer, but maybe just bringing it up, it's like, you know, you get some funky looks. Oh, you're one of those. It's like, well, I don't know, but maybe the pragmatic approach isn't all there is to life. Maybe there is something to having principles and beliefs. That's a whole tangent we could go on, but I think that what you're saying is true, that most people are pragmatic, and that has its own set of problems, because that could be easily taken advantage of.
Sure. Corrupted.
Yeah, absolutely.
The left in this country currently, I mean, they talk about having an ideology, and then all these things are assigned to them, from, you know, postmodernism to the Frankfurt School to, you know, a social justice war. But at the political level, it's just about power. And the current president of this country doesn't have an ideology either, right? He just wanted to be president.
That's what Kissinger saw best in him, said that he had no ideology, and he may turn out to be one of the most influential presidents ever, because he has no direct ideology, and he could be steered in different directions. He may be willing to do things that other leaders, based on their ideology, may not do.
Yeah. So when Trump got elected, I was living in northern New Hampshire, and I was dating this professor at Dartmouth University. I don't know exactly how I fell into this. And her specialization was Machiavelli, which also made me a little nervous, but she was definitely more oriented towards the left, but very pragmatic. And she was not one of these hysterical academics about Donald Trump. She's like, this guy's great. He's a blank slate. If he just cares about staying liked and staying popular, we can write what we want on him. And she wasn't wrong.